Let's get started on another week of our 4.5-year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired word by opening to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter number 2 is where we are going to begin. We've already introduced the main character, which is Nehemiah, who was cupbearer to the king, which I believe was more than just a simple waiter position. I believe that he may have been involved in the administration of all of the banquets that took place in the palace and in the kingdom itself for the Persian Empire. But Nehemiah was a godly man. And once he found out that things had still not been fully resolved at Jerusalem, meaning that even 13 years after Ezra had gone there, the walls were still unbuilt, the gates were still charred ruins, and the city was not heavily occupied. Nehemiah prayed about that. He confessed the sins of the Jewish people, which brought the destruction of Jerusalem over 150 years earlier, and confessed his own sins and the sins of his family. And then he asked God to give him favor in the sight of a specific man. And the man he had in mind was King Artaxerxes. And so we pick up the story today in the month of Nisan, which is the first Jewish month, means we're in the springtime, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, which places us in the spring of 444 BC. When wine was before him, I took up the wine and gave it to the king. So he is doing part of his job, which is to be the one personally responsible for selecting the vintage that the king is drinking at any particular moment in his life. Now, I had not been sad in his presence. Now, he had known for the last several months about the things that were going on in Jerusalem, or perhaps we better say, not going on. And he had been fasting intermittently about it, praying about it on a regular basis, but he had done very much the thing that Jesus taught in his Sermon on the Mount, which is when you fast, you go about your normal business. When you get up in the morning, you wash your face, you put on the oil, and then you go through your life as if nothing's happening. So that is exactly what Nehemiah was doing. He was keeping his fasting and his prayer, his intense prayer, quiet whenever he was at work. But on this particular day, for some reason, it came through. The king said to me, "Why is your face sad, seeing that you're not sick? This is nothing but sadness of the heart." So the king has sensed, probably over the last few days, maybe the last few weeks, that there was something amiss, that he was intimate with Nehemiah. And he finally asks him, he says, What's going on, Nehemiah? You're not physically ill. What's the issue? Tell me about it." Then I was very much afraid. Now, some people, I don't know why, want to say that Nehemiah was afraid that the king was going to do something to him, that he was going to punish him for showing a little bit of emotion in his presence, or that perhaps he was suspecting that he might be involved in a plot. I reject all of that out of hand because of the clear, intimate relationship that existed between the two men and between Nehemiah and the queen as well. They were as close as a boss who is a king and a servant can be best friends. And so he is afraid here because suddenly he must verbalize before the king the thing he's been bouncing around in his head, which is he wants to go to Jerusalem as the new Jewish governor and rebuild the walls. So all of a sudden, that's right in front of him. And that is why he was afraid. He does not want to mess up this opportunity. So I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should not my face be sad when the city, the place of my father's graves, lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire?" So he says, effectively, why shouldn't I be sad when Jerusalem, the place where my ancestors' graves are, is a ruin still to this day? Verse 4, "Then the king said to me, 'What are you requesting?'" So what is it you want, Nehemiah? "And so I prayed to the God of heaven." So this is exactly the thing he was looking for. And so he shoots up one more prayer request to God instantly. "Please let him give me my request." Now, I love the style of Nehemiah prayer, where you're just constantly ready to ask and speak to God about the things that are in your life. I'm sure from time to time I look like a crazy person walking down the street or driving in my car, and I'm carrying on an animated conversation and where I'm talking to God. Now, in more modern time where people are constantly on cell phones and car phones, I probably don't look nearly as crazy. But that, I think, is the essence of that pray without ceasing thing that you see in Paul's writings. We should understand we are constantly in God's presence and can speak to him about anything. So here's Nehemiah. He prays to God in the moment. "And then I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, that you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it.'" So he makes the request, "Let me be the new governor of the Judea province, specifically of Judea, of Jerusalem, so that I can rebuild the walls and the major portions of the city." Verse 6, "The king said to me," the queen sitting beside him. So the queen is right there, and she's brought into the story, I think, because of the fact there is this friendship between the royal couple and Nehemiah. And it's probably a fairly long-term one. He's been serving in this administrative office of wine, of the wine steward to the king for probably many years now. And so she would be interested in knowing, well, how's this going to impact on your work with us? So the king says, "How long will you be gone? When will you return?" So his biggest concern is, how long do you think it's going to take for you to get all of this stuff done and then come back and serve us again? So it pleased the king to send me when I had given him a time. So he gives him a specific time. Later we'll see, I think he spends 13 years or so during this time. Before he comes back to the king. I don't know if he requested that much time to begin with, but certainly it would have been a significant amount of time for him to function as the governor of the Jewish people in the Jewish territory. Verse 7, "I said to the king, 'If it pleases the king, let letters be given me to the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may let me pass through until I come to Judah.'" And we've talked about this beyond the river thing before. The Persian Empire sprawled over the ancient world. From the foothills of the Himalayas near India in the east, all the way to the western end of what we call Turkey today in the west. And so that whole area near the Greek Aegean Sea. up into Armenia, to the north, almost to the Caucasus Mountains, to the north, and then deep down into the Arabian Peninsula and down into Egypt and Ethiopia on the south. And so there's a lot of territory. And so there are governors that govern the area south of the Euphrates River. And he will need documentation to say that he and his entourage have the king's express permission to move through that region to Judah and then take up office there. So he's asking for all of the passport documents, visa documents, things like that. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I shall occupy. So he also has to have permission to secure royal timber, probably from the Lebanon area of the Middle East, because that's some of the best timber in the region, which he plans on using in the rebuilding of all of the gates around the city of Jerusalem. You got to have some pretty big, heavy-duty lumber for that. Plus, he plans on maybe doing a little bit of work around the Temple Mount and building, we're going to call it a palace, but he calls it here a house, in the city of Jerusalem for the governor. Up to this point, in the last, it's almost 150 years since Jerusalem was destroyed. During that time, the Jewish governor of the area lived to the north and a little bit west of Jerusalem at Mizpah. Well, it's Nehemiah's conviction that the governor of Judah should live at the capital city, Jerusalem. So he's going to build a house for himself. And so the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. And that language is very similar to the language we saw in the book of Ezra about the scribe when he came back about 13 years previous to this. And we'll get around to meeting Ezra again. But apparently, Ezra's early efforts to rebuild the wall were stopped by opposition from non-Jews in the region. And then Ezra just kind of took up responsibility of maintaining the religious worship lifestyle of the Jewish people in and around Jerusalem. So he's kind of just taken on a housekeeping role, if you will. But he'll be brought back by Nehemiah to a very prominent role. Verse number 9. Then I came to the governors of the province beyond the river and gave them the king's letters. Now, we'll discover later that the key guys that he's running into that are called the governors beyond the river are the guys living up in what we call Samaria in the New Testament period, up near the mountains of Ebal and Gerizim, up by Shechem. That seems to have become the new governing point for the non-Jewish people living in the area. And so he would have passed through there on his way to Judah, because the central highway goes right past that place. And so he delivers his authorization letters to become the new Jewish governor. Now the king had sent with me officers of the army and horsemen. And so they also have all the documents that they need for their official move. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite servant heard this, it displeased them greatly that someone had come to seek the welfare of the people of Israel. So these guys, that are in charge now had probably been involved in some form or fashion with stopping the building of the walls by Ezra about 13 years earlier. And so now there is in this documentation specific authorization to rebuild the wall. And that does not make these guys happy. And they will do their best to try to stop it. Verse number 11. So I went to Jerusalem and I was there 3 days. Now it's probably about the fourth month of the Jewish year at this point. Probably toward the tail end of that month that he arrived. And so when he first arrives, he does some of the things that are necessary for a new governor to take care of. But verse number 12 says that at the end of that 3-day period, I arose in the night, I and a few men with me, and I told no one what my God had put into my heart to do for Jerusalem. So he has not yet revealed to everyone that he is here to rebuild the walls, to reinitiate that project started by Ezra 13 years ago. So he wants to do a little private survey of the walls. And he does it at night. There was no animal with me but the one on which I rode. Don't know what it is. It's either a horse or a donkey, more than likely. I went out by night by the valley gate. Now, at this point, we're going to talk about geography around the city of Jerusalem. And I love the fact that I've been in Jerusalem 3 times now and have been able to walk in many of the places that are described here and have seen the topography firsthand because it makes it much easier for me to describe it to you. By the way, we're planning on making another trip to Israel, God willing, in October of 2023. So that's still more than a year in the future. If there's any of you that are interested in maybe making that trip with me and seeing some of these places firsthand, then get online with the website, intotheword.net, and look there for the highlight link about this upcoming trip. So anyway, the first thing you have to understand about the geography is that the oldest portion of the city of Jerusalem, the thing that's called the City of David, which the Canaanites refer to as Jebus, it is a long oval-shaped hill to the south of the Temple Mount. And it is surrounded by valleys on 3 sides with the Temple Mount to the north. So the Kidron Valley is along its east side. The what used to be referred to as the Tyropean Valley is on the west side. And then on the south, just barely kind of touching it, is the Hinnom Valley because the Kidron, the Tyropean, and the Hinnom Valley all come together just immediately south of the Pool of Siloam, which is the southernmost big man-made object in the city of David. So the valley gate that he is going out of is the gate that leaves the newer portion, the Solomonic portion of Jerusalem to the north, the part that was near the Temple Mount, and heads down into the Tyropean Valley, the lower valley that goes along the western side of the city of David. The valley gate, as far as I can tell, must have been somewhere near the modern Jewish Dung Gate, which is the access point from the south to the Western Wall Plaza. So he says, I went out by night by the valley gate to the Dragon Spring, the Septuagint, which is the Greek Old Testament, actually talks about this being the Fig Spring. not the dragon spring. There is a word for fig in Hebrew that looks very similar to the word in Hebrew for dragon or jackal. And so I think that the actual reading here is the fig spring, which we're not exactly sure where that's at. So he went from the valley gate southward, apparently past the fig spring, and then to the dung gate. Now, this is the more ancient dung gate. It is the southernmost gate on the east, or excuse me, the western side of the old city of David. And it was probably given this name Dung Gate because of what was typically carried out of it into the Hinnom Valley at the point where the Tirupian and the Kidron Valleys joined it. And it's not necessarily just manure, although there would have been a need to carry that out of the city. But it's a word in Hebrew that refers to almost any sort of castaway material. So we could almost call it the refuse gate or the junk gate, the garbage gate. So that's the name of it. We know pretty much where it's at because it is always in close association with the Pool of Siloam. And we know exactly where the Pool of Siloam is. So he goes out by night through the valley gate, goes south past the fig pool or the fig spring, and then down to the dung gate or the refuse gate. And I inspected the walls of Jerusalem that were broken down and its gates that had been destroyed by fire. So he is making a visual inspection of the damage done 150 years earlier. He's never seen it himself. He's always heard about it. But now he's seeing it firsthand. He sees the rubble where the stones were pushed down, many of them had been broken because of fire. There are charred pieces of timber here and there near the gates. There's probably the base layer of the wall still in place because it wouldn't have been needed to be totally dug up because once you took down the wall, then the city was open to destruction anyway. So he's following the old footprint of the wall line along the eastern, I keep saying that wrong, sorry, the western side of the old city of David, and he's taking note of where the gates used to be because of the charred remains. Verse 14, then I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool. So now he's swung around the southern end of the old city of Jerusalem, and he's heading up the eastern side of the wall, following the wall footprint. The fountain gate would have been the access point to the Pool of Siloam, which here is referred to as the king's pool, because King Hezekiah is the one that made the Pool of Siloam. Whenever he made his engineers stop the Gihon spring from pouring its water out into the Kidron Valley, he didn't want the potential enemies having access to all that fresh water. So he stopped the waters of the Gihon spring from going outside the walls of Jerusalem, and by a tunnel underground called now the Hezekiah's Tunnel, he diverted or sent those waters to this pool in the southern point of the ancient city of Jerusalem. And the Pool of Siloam actually means the sent pool, the pool where the water was sent. And so that's why it's probably also referred to here as the king's pool, as in King Hezekiah's pool. So he sees all of that on the extreme southeast corner of Jerusalem, that is the ancient part of it, city of David, and he's still trying to go northward along that wall. But he says this, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. So he's now in the Kidron Valley, and the valley is either so overgrown because it's not been worked as a cultivated field for perhaps 150 years. So it's like almost a little mini jungle. But there's also refuse or junk left over from the destruction of Jerusalem 150 years earlier. So the path is not possible for his mount, for his horse or his donkey. So he gets off, verse 15. And then I went up in the night by the valley and inspected the wall. So he goes a little bit farther, at least up this Kidron Valley on the eastern side of the ancient city of David. Perhaps he gets as far as the Gihon Spring area, or maybe he even goes up as far as where he could see the eastern side of the palace complex for David. But at some point, he decides that he's seen enough, and he turns back, and it says, I entered by the valley gate and so returned. So he turns around, he comes back, and goes back in where he was. And the officials did not know where I'd gone or what I was doing, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, the officials, and the rest who were to do the work. So he has now made his own personal inspection on the southern area of the city of Jerusalem's ruins, the city of David region. And so he has apparently a particular interest in it. It may be because it's the most ancient part where the tombs of the kings and so many of the monuments related to David are located. Come back tomorrow and we will continue with Nehemiah's story.